Speaking of Reliability, a podcast with good friends talking with you about reliability engineering topics.
Welcome to Speaking of Reliability. This is Carl Carlson.
And this is Fred Schenkelberg.
Hey, Fred. We were just podcasting on this subject a little while ago on safety, and is it a binary topic, or is it a concept, or is it a variable? And we were approaching towards the end the safety tools and reliability tools and the overlaps between them, and I thought that'd be an interesting discussion with you. You brought up that, quite correctly, for example, fault tree analysis is not necessarily sufficient when you have complex equipment. There are other tools in addition to that, and of course we have our book that's coming out that talks about reliability plans, mm-hmm. which then aggregate or bring together all the different methods and tools. I'll call it the vital few tools that need to be used on a given project. And I thought it'd be interesting to explore the difference between safety methods and reliability methods and the overlap, whether they are really the part of the same bucket or whether they're different, and in what way, so that we could have a discussion about it. What do you think?
Oh, well, certainly can talk about it. Here's the way I think of it. Is one, I'm a reliability engineer, I guess, tried and true and card carry and everything else. So I think all of quality is a reliability subset, and all of safety is a reliability subset. But that's just me. But
we should explore that topic as well.
Yeah, but let me explain. What I think safety and quality do. And reliability has to do this too, is it sets a criteria or threshold or element of, well, what's considered safe enough, what's considered reliable enough, what's considered good enough from a quality point of view. And each organization is going to define these in their various different ways. Some are better than others, and all three sets of definitions, and some focus on one to the detriment of the other two, for example. Yet it's how does the aggregate of this product perform in real life? And then what we measure and what we monitor and what we track then can be bucketed as, well, that was a safety problem. You know, it caught on fire and burned the house down. Well, that was the safety issue. The product itself really doesn't care what you're going to call it, right? It could be considered a quality issue because this component shorted out and it shouldn't have, and that was a manufacturing defect. And we're going to call that a process variability issue when we get into the details, and then we charge our quality team to fix that, right? But the media doesn't care. If they get all of it, they're going to call it a safety issue and your product's not safe. And then the engineering team, the reliability folks are saying, well, that component wore out, or we had, you know, dendrite growth or something like that, and we'll employ various parts to it. So I don't like the idea that we separate these into different buckets and then create silos of it. I think that's just a misguided approach to thinking about these three different topics.
Yeah, let's I'm going to fully agree with this. And I want to take it even broader. We used the term at General Motors years back. We used the term QRDP, mm-hmm. quality, reliability, durability, performance, mm-hmm. as if they're totally separate. I mean, we can talk about quality and what initial quality is and what quality means. We can talk about reliability. There's even a discussion about durability. Clearly, there's a discussion about performance. And of course, there's a discussion about safety, hazards, risk. There's all types of ways that we could look at product performance.
Right.
But what you said, and I completely agree with, the customer doesn't differentiate all of these things. Now, they might differentiate if you have a conversation about a nuance. In other words, do you like the color of this device? Then you might say, okay, well, that's not a safety issue. There's more of a quality
Yeah, no, I laugh because it can be. It really, really can be. I saw a study years and years ago that red cars have more head-on collisions than other cars. And it was a nuance of the people that buy red cars and drive red cars are seeking performance and tended to drive more aggressively. Just
okay, so now we're talking causation versus correlation.
Oh, I know, but if it wasn't red, then they wouldn't be navigating to these particular high performance cars. And you know, it was a marker in that realm. And then there's red.
So a more risky driver might correlate to buy a red vehicle.
Well, that was
if you put pressure on them and say, okay, I'm going to force you to buy a dark vehicle, does that change their risk?
So that was one piece of the argument. The other piece is that red cars are not common on the road. And so when you're going down the road and you see a red vehicle here in the United States and Western countries, that's danger. Is that a red flasher? Or is that a red? The red signals something that when you look at something, when you're driving, you tend to go towards something that you look at. It's funny, is people, when you're learning to drive, I asked the instructor, what's the most common thing you see people do wrong? He says, well, if there's a light pole in the middle of the parking lot and it's completely empty, he said, I've lost count of how many people have run into it. It's a completely empty parking lot.
So their attention goes to that.
And there's the phenomena that correlates to that, is that if you see something like a deer in the road, you're probably going to hit it. because you're looking at it. Which way is it going to go? Where is it going to go? And your behavior is that you'll go towards it. Unconsciously, you'll drift towards it. And then it went on like three, four other things like that. And then there's, it could be a quality issue. The color changes color with UV radiation over a year or so, and it causes a problem. Or the color of the dashboard changes to it becomes a very obscuring distraction on the windshield, and it obscures your vision, and now it's a safety issue. So it's
interesting discussion, and there's so many places this discussion could go. Like if you're in your vehicle and you have the touch screen, you know, the 7 or 8 inch touch screen, mm-hmm. that where you interact with the entertainment system, if that suddenly gets fuzzy, you might have to spend more time finding what you need to, which means you could get into an accident.
Yep.
And so we can get into a lot of nuances. I use the example, because in FMEA you have to assess whether what the effect is, the consequence of a failure mode is, and how severe is it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really important part of FMEA, because if it's high severity, like safety related, then that triggers more attention and follow-up. So I pose to these students, I say, well, okay, so the radio knob, this tells you how old I am.
Yeah.
Radios have knobs.
Yeah. Well, at least you didn't use push buttons.
Yes. Falls off. Right. Okay, so the radio knob falls off in your vehicle. Now, is that a loss of performance, complete loss of performance, or is that a degradation of performance because, you know, the knob's still there? It just doesn't have the big knob, but the little spindle is there, and mm-hmm. you can still change the volume. Or is that a safety problem because you're, as a driver, you're going to try to lean over and pick up the knob?
Yeah. So I'm going to call this yes. Yes, all three. So, and it really is, you know, in the eye of that driver is how they respond to the circumstance. You know, for me, in my old car that had a radio, I had vice grips in the glove box because I always had vice grips. You could fix all kinds of stuff with a pair of vice grips and duct tape. And so, I mean, I would just put the vice grip on that spindle and change the gestation. You know, it'd be a degradation of performance, but I had a workaround immediately available. Right. And that was just me.
So we're the first part of our discussion here is we're downgrading the need to create silos of tools. In other words, we don't think it's real important that you have a quality set of tools versus a reliability set of tools versus a safety set as a hard differentiator.
Right.
There may be emphasis. Some tools may lend themselves to more, to different applications, but we don't see a lot of value in making those with a big firewall between them.
Right.
The second topic is, how about organizational structures? And I've seen, let me just throw out a few. In GM, we had a debate for a long time as to whether the reliability group reported to the quality vice president and whether the reliability methodologies were really a subset of quality or vice versa.
Right.
Were the quality tools really part of the reliability umbrella? And so organizationally, it went back and forth for many years. And I always advise companies, because they ask me this a lot, I say so much depends on how enlightened the VP is. In other words, if the VP is not enlightened, this is a really important subject. But
yeah.
If they're enlightened, it's not as important.
See, my take on that from where I grew up in industry was, you don't need either a VP of quality or reliability.
Yes.
You don't need either of those or departments. It really should be embedded in the design and manufacturing organizations. It's part and parcel to being a manufacturing engineer or design engineer. And the project managers in each of those organizations should be the leads on quality, safety, reliability, environmental, you know, production, functionality, everything. And I've seen organizations work that way and do amazingly well. And I've seen organizations with great big departments for reliability or quality or safety and be dismal at it. And vice versa too, by the way.
In fact, let's make a little note here, both of us can, that a future topic is, how do you organize reliability as a function in your company? Because what I've always believed is that when you do design for reliability, there has to be a certain amount of, I'll call it air cover, to use the military term.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to have a certain amount of protection, because if you put the reliability group, and I'm stealing the thunder of a future podcast, but if you put the reliability group in the fix-it department that's trying to fix field problems, they will never have the time needed to do a proper job of design for reliability, because they're always going out and fighting fires.
Right.
So there's this whole subject which we can allocate to a future podcast, is what's the best way to organize the reliability group?
And I certainly have opinions on that one, it's no doubt. But back to this idea of, I think the difference, and we're talking about safety and reliability and their overlap. I think we're clear that there's a wondrous set of tools out there that are not unique domains of one or the other. Now, there are types of tools and parts of organizations that will specialize, say on a fault tree analysis type stuff, and or some other types of modeling, like hazard analysis. This is typically required in regulatory agencies, and it's a different focus. It's on customer harm or patient harm is the focus of those things, and minimizing or understanding the various situations that would lead to patient harm and trying to minimize those things. And so some teams will have somebody that's gets how this regulatory agency wants a hazard analysis done, and they specialize in it. Whereas the tool interacts with the production, with vendors, with your design considerations, all of those elements have to fit into part of it. And so I think the tools are fluid and overlap and depends on their outcome. But I think where they are separate is, I think of it as like a sphere. And we have a boundary on one side of this system that's defined by, well, how reliable do we want it? What's our objective there? What's considered good or not good enough? And same for safety on the one part of it. And the third part is, well, what's the quality characteristics and how we define those? And as we talked about it a little bit last time, is that one of the variables is, how do we interpret, is it good enough or not against that particular vector of safety or quality or reliability? And that varies. And the more it's understood and delineated and clear to the organization, the better that organization is able to say, no, we've gone too far. That's not going to be reliable enough, or that's not safe enough. And we got to focus on it. It doesn't, that's the way I separate them, is they're different sets of measures, and our threshold is set by local policy or by community acceptance or whatever.
Yeah, I get the concept. If we had a chalkboard, we could, but just imagine now, if you're a listener, we talk about circles. So you could look at a safety circle, a reliability circle, a quality circle, and there's a lot of overlap in those domains. And then you could state something like you brought up, Fred, which is hazard analysis tends to be more of safety applications because it's focused on safety hazards. FMEA crosses those boundaries because it focuses on safety as well as performance, as well as quality, yep, particularly the types of FMEAs. And then there's a certain quality tools like SPC tends to be more in the quality arena. And so, but there's a tremendous amount of overlap in it. And anybody that tries to spend too much time allocating tools to those domains is probably not value added in terms of time spent. The important thing is to understand scope. So if you have a reliability plan, for example, yes, you should take into account safety. And I always try to take into account quality in addition to reliability, in addition to maintainability, in addition to supportability.
Well, you got to add performance in there too, because I think all of the trade-offs apply in every one of those domains. It might be we're representing the reliability performance at the table, yet it's connected in so many different ways to all of those other performance issues, functionality issues, quality, you know, domains, cost domains, time to market domain. They're all fluid all the time. And I think by understanding those things, you can achieve the right balance for the program. And that's the objective. It's not to make the most safe thing. Well, I had a neighbor of mine years and years ago. He was semi-retired and he was doing legal work and he was a chemical engineer. And his comment one night was, I don't know why anybody ever brings a product to market in the U.S. It's just ridiculous. Uh-huh. He was, you know, getting involved in one case after another where there was some little, you know, something gets missed and some lawyer gets a hold of it and they're doing a case and he's, you know, trying to defend them for this, that, and the other thing. And, but it's never only, his opinion was, and it stuck with me, is that the only safe product you can put on the market is the one you don't put on the market. You don't try to sell it. You don't make it. You can have a concept all day long, but just don't try to make it, because that's just not going to be safe to somebody somewhere.
So let me explore the performance part, because I'm going to agree with you, but I want to explain how in what way I'm agreeing. My first run-in with reliability versus performance, if there is such a concept at all, mm-hmm, when I was a supervisor in a door testing lab in Fisher Body, back in when there was a Fisher Body. This goes back into the 1980s. And we would fail windows, door system windows, for different reasons. And one of the reasons was the window would not go up or down. Mm-hmm. That's a clear failure.
Right.
But then I was asked the question, well, what if it doesn't go up or down in the required time? Like there was a certain time element in the specifications as well as a temperature. And then they said, isn't that a performance problem but not a reliability problem? And I go, that does not make sense to me at all. Because you have a requirement. Remember, reliability is a probability that an item will perform its intended function under the conditions of use and over a certain period of time. So the intended function is not just that the window goes up or down, but that it goes up or down in a required time.
Right.
And if it doesn't do that, who cares whether you call it a reliability problem, a performance problem, a safety problem, or what? It's a problem. So it fits the definition of reliability on the four elements.
Right.
But the argument, we had that argument for years, and I just tried to avoid it because it doesn't matter to the customer.
No.
What we call it.
No, it doesn't matter. And you know, if the specification is related to customers' expectations, that, you know, if I hit the power up button and it takes it 3 days to get up to the top, well, I'm going to return it. That's a problem, right? But if it's an eighth of a second off of its requirements, well, then you got that requirement pretty darn good because I really don't care. It's good enough. But if you miss it by a long shot, yeah, I'm going to return that and get it repaired, you know, kind of thing. So the specifications in my mind are an attempt for us to understand what we can measure that's related to customers' acceptance or expectations. And if it's just arbitrary, well, then you're going to get arbitrary results out of the end of the day. And that's not a reliability or quality or other issue. It's a process issue of understanding the customer's requirements. And that relates to safety and quality and reliability and all the other illities that are out there. But I agree with you is that if it doesn't meet the spec, if the spec is good, right, or related to what the customers want, well, it's a problem. There's some issue here that needs to be resolved, and you can call it whatever you want. Just fix it. That was the way I thought.
Yeah, in fact, let's summarize this podcast discussion in the following way. If we really look at that definition of reliability, the probability that the item will perform its intended function.
Italics applied by the author there.
Yes. Then the intended function could be safety related, could be performance related. It doesn't matter. It's whatever that intended function is, and it's usually a set of functions, and that it does what it's intended to do, then we could call it a reliability problem. You could call it a performance. It doesn't matter. It's important that we address it, and that is, and then you can have a metric around it if you want to, that of course, that it's a reliability metric at that point. But it all falls into this intended function point, which covers, it's an umbrella that covers safety, it covers quality, it covers performance. All of those things are part of the function of the item, and that they're measured in that reliability metric.
Yep. And this might be a good topic for a whole nother podcast. We got a whole series going here. Is that goes back to what I opened with, is basically all of these other things are just subsets of reliability, because you can create a quality product on day one or a safe product on day one. If it doesn't age well, which is often considered a part of reliability, and if it's aged for X amount of time in that definition of how long we expect customers to use this thing, and it becomes unsafe or it becomes functional, gets degraded or whatever, I don't care whether that's a reliability problem or not, but it's an aspect of that. We got to do all the safety stuff, we got to do all the quality stuff, and we got to do it over time. And
yes,
the safety department doesn't stop or shouldn't stop when they get it meet the regulation with a new product. Well, what happens as it ages? And we use reliability tools often to answer that question. And same for quality and so on. That's why I think, maybe a bit biased, that reliability is a superset of all those things. But I could be dissuaded, I guess.
Well, probably not. I mean, you're on solid ground. I think the other part to the aging is reasonably anticipated misuse of a product, and so all of this comes together. And it's and the why this is so important. I mean, this is a reliability podcast. Why this is so important as reliability engineers? We don't want you to have blinders on. We want you to look at the entire product and how the product is used by customers. And whether it's safe and reliable, whether all these different aspects, to me, is part of the scope of reliability engineering.
Yep. Well said. We'll summarize it right there. So if you've got an opinion on this, either agree or disagree with us, we'd love to hear from you. Head over to ascendoreliability.com/go/SOR, and there you'll find a SpeakPipe widget that allows you to actually record up to 90 seconds. We'd love to hear your voice. Let us know what you think, and it may well make its way into a future podcast. We'll also, there's a contact form there. You can find Carl and I and the other hosts on LinkedIn or on our About pages. And as always, we encourage you to take part in the conversation. So with that, Carl, I think I'm just going to sit in my car, not go anywhere. I think that's probably the safest it'll be today.
I'm going to sit in my room, but even that's got a certain amount of risk.
That's true. Yeah. You know, underneath redwoods, I don't think there's a lot of safe places with the size of branches that fall on. But, anyway, it works. All right. Thanks, Carl. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Fred.
Thanks for listening to Speaking of Reliability. We invite you to join the conversation if you have a question or a topic that you think we should discuss in a future show. Please let us know. You can find a comment box below the episode show notes, or just leave a note as part of a review on iTunes.